Part 1. The Journey. Chapter 1. Sweets, sweets. What am I doing here? I stood listlessly beside my friend Alf Tiedemann in the vestibule of the large summer house where Sai Baba resides when he is in Bangalore. It was evening. Bugs aimlessly circled the lights, and a lizard was scurrying in fitful zigs and zags up the wall. I wondered how he was able to hold on. My eyes strained, looking for the suction cup on its feet. I was exhausted. My bones and rear end ached from sitting for long, tedious hours cross-legged on the ground. My stomach grumbled in reaction to unfamiliar hot Indian dishes. I'd lost 10 pounds in 10 days. A primitive ceiling fan revolved in annoying monotony overhead, barely circulating the air and not stirring my sluggish, dejected spirits at all. Two large wooden elephants on pedestals, trunks raised, guarded the door from the vestibule to the inner house. To one side, in front of me, was a footstool and a chair, covered with bits of red velvet, which resembled a small throne. Frequently occupied by Sai Baba, it was almost the only piece of furniture in the barren room. "You wouldn't catch me dead in India," my brother Don had graciously and sympathetically volunteered on my departure. "Sam, what are you looking for? You're a successful psychiatrist with a nice university position. You have a healthy and happy family. You're living by the ocean in the best climate in the world. What in the world more could you want? You're acting foolhardy and crazy going to India after some dream, jeopardizing your health and making your family sad." I had often questioned this inner discontent myself, this old yearning inside to find a deeper meaning in life. Now, all the recent literature bubbling up in the West regarding clairvoyance, telepathy, and people with apparent healing powers, the question of other levels of consciousness, other dimensions of reality, did such phenomena actually exist? And even if they did, could they shed any light on the meaning and purpose of life? Wasn't it just neurotic to travel halfway around the world in pursuit of a man reputed to know the answers to these ancient questions and supposedly able to form miracles besides? I had been involved in psychiatry for 9 years. In addition to my private practice, I was an assistant clinical professor in psychiatry at the University of California in San Diego, had treated thousands of patients, and in the process of my training, gone through my own treatment, searching for many years for a way to deeper meaning and deeper peace, and still I was yearning and searching. "I hope you're happy now, Sam," I thought miserably. "This Sai Baba, supposedly in possession of Christ-like powers, hasn't given you a second glance. He doesn't know you exist." "But he can materialize objects," I had been told. "He is omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent, all love." After 10 days in his presence, I remained doubtful. Every once in a while, he appeared to be materializing something, but I was too far away to see what he was doing. In any case, who in his right mind could actually believe another human being capable of producing something from thin air? Oh, of course, magic tricks and deception are another matter. Sai Baba had just delivered a 90-minute discourse to some 500 people that was totally unsettling to me. What he had said was not just contrary to contemporary psychiatric thought. It seemed years behind the times and psychologically unsophisticated. His uninformed challenge to my system of beliefs was the last straw. How could I even, for a moment, consider this foolishness? Trained in the most advanced country in the world, in the best schools, exposed to the leading theories, the latest practices and techniques in psychiatry, how could I expect to find anything worthwhile here? I knew more about the mind and emotions, the way to inner peace, than anyone in this primitive, underdeveloped country. Sai Baba teach me anything about the way to inner peace? This whole trip was just an exercise in self-torment. In a few moments, Alf and I would retreat down the walkway from the ashram, spiritual community, to our cab and head back to Bangalore. Several walls separated us from the back of the house where loud and lasting applause signaled the end of a talk. We stood silently. I'm feeling terrible, Alf, like being torn apart. I might even have to go home early. Alf nodded, a tired smile on his face. I looked down at the floor, at my bare feet, wiggling my toes for entertainment. My trip had been a failure. I had come seeking the meaning of life and had found confusion. I had seen no miracles, no superhuman powers. I was one of thousands unrecognized by Sai Baba. I was a fool and it was time to go home. Then suddenly he appeared. Quickly and gracefully, he walked up to us, smiling and full of joy. He held out two pieces of candy, saying, "Sweets, sweets." His blissful, loving gaze held my own transfixed. What a message in those eyes! They seemed to tell of an understanding beyond my comprehension. I felt a chill and the clear impression that this man actually knew and was responding to my sense of despair. In 10 days, he hadn't given me a sign of recognition. How could he now know who I was and what I was thinking when a moment ago he had been surrounded by hundreds and I had been nowhere in sight? What was communicated in that brief moment? The world. Something broke inside of me. Some of Sai Baba's joy and love penetrated my soul, and I felt myself laughing like a child. There was such love and gentleness and caring in this man's presence. Who was he? Puffed up, self-worth, an egotistical attachment to my own particular values and beliefs seemed to shatter into dust, suddenly giving way to a sense of awe and mystery. I felt somehow transformed in one dazzling, incredible moment. Then realized that everyone can be transformed in this way. Everyone has such glorious potential. Baba turned swiftly and disappeared the way he had come, leaving me with my mouth hanging open, feeling dazed and humble. "What was that?" I finally managed to ask Alf, staring blankly into his beaming face. "Well, if you believe that's ordinary candy, Sam, you're sorely mistaken," he said. "Eat." I ate the candy, feeling its sweetness in my mouth, matched by a most marvelous sensation welling up inside my body. As I looked at Alf, I could feel the radiance on my own face. "I'll stay," I said. This chapter ends with a quotation from Satya Sai Baba. "However high a bird may soar, it has sooner or later to perch on a treetop to enjoy quiet. So too, a day will come when even the most haughty, the most willful, the most unbelieving, even those who assert that there is no joy or peace in the contemplation of the higher self, will have to pray, 'God, grant me peace. Grant me consolation, strength, and joy.'" Chapter 2. Good News. In late 1971, I began looking for someone to teach me yoga and meditation. I had been experimenting with a number of newer psychotherapeutic techniques and felt that in some of these, the West was actually approaching yogic or spiritual practices known for thousands of years in the East. How had these ancient cultures understood human nature? And how did spiritual practice lead to improved mental health? I learned that Indra Devi, a woman with an international reputation in yoga, had a ranch and yoga retreat in Tecate, Mexico, only 50 miles from San Diego, and it was my good fortune to be invited graciously to her home for a talk. It was destined to be an interesting and important meeting. After crossing the border, my wife Sharon and I made our way through the small town of Tecate and onto a narrow dirt road which wound through foothills to a large area open and quiet at the base of a mountain. This was Rancho La Cuchuma. I had the strange feeling of entering another world, removed by more than distance from the hustle of San Diego. The warm sun was gentle and soothing, the silence penetrating. Indra Devi's large old Spanish home was an experience in its own right. As Sharon and I entered the house, we were met by a large poster. An Indian man with Negroid features, a natural Afro hairstyle, and brilliant orange robe stood amongst seated admirers who gazed up at him with reverence and devotion. I found the poster and its placement a bit unusual, having never before come across this sort of display on entering someone's home. Indra Devi came down to greet us, and she was like a breath of fresh air. She was wearing an unusual, very interesting scent, almost like incense, and I had the impression that she was marvelously open, as if I could actually feel a breeze passing through her body. Motioning us to follow, she led us through the house, singing a strange chanting song, which I later learned to be a bhajan, or devotional song. Our conversation soon turned to the mysterious man of the poster, Satya Sai Baba. It seemed that no matter what I asked, her mind was channeled to Sai Baba. Sai Baba this and Sai Baba that, until I began to consider how unusual it was for a woman in her 70s to have such a reaction. It is not, of course, at all uncommon for someone who is young and looking for guidance to become devoted to a teacher, but Indra Devi was a mature, sophisticated woman. In the course of her extensive travels, she had visited most of the major ashrams and met some of the most evolved yogis and sadhus, spiritual men, in India. For her, suddenly, in the later years of her life, to become so devoted to another person, a mere mortal, this I found to be quite unusual and interesting. 6 years ago, she said, Sai Baba transformed my life. He is a master and teacher whose powers are beyond comprehension. To my growing dismay and disbelief, she began to recount a seemingly endless list of his powers. He could, for example, materialize things out of thin air. She described witnessing numerous such materializations, showing me how, by waving his hand in circles, he produced vibhuti, or sacred ash, a substance supposed to possess spiritual and healing properties, similar for the Hindu to the holy water of Catholicism. She demonstrated how he had taken a large metallic urn filled with vibhuti right out of the sky, merely by making a few of these horizontal, clockwise circles with his right hand. Baba had told her that the urn would replenish itself and never be emptied. And indeed, over the next few years, she said, although she had given out much of this vibhuti, and the urn had been almost empty on a number of occasions, it had, somehow, always replenished itself. This respected teacher and writer then went on to describe still other superhuman abilities which she attributed to Sai Baba. It was said that he had stopped rainstorms, made a rainbow appear in front of a doubting observer, protected people by influencing the events of men and forces of nature, instantaneously rescued devotees from danger at a great distance from himself, and even that he had raised at least one person from the dead. After that, it did not surprise me to hear her say that Sai Baba knew the past, present, and future of everyone who came before him, that he could transform himself into other, including non-human, forms, or that he could be in two places at once. In spite of this proliferation of amazing capabilities, Sai Baba's greatest miracle, according to Indra Devi, was the genuineness of his spiritual insight and his ability to turn people Godward. She said that one wishing to feel what it must have been like to experience Christ or Buddha or Krishna should go to Baba, because he embodies them all. Quote, "One is enveloped in such a highly charged aura of love in his presence, such a profoundly spiritual and holy atmosphere, that many are transformed on the spot, and almost everyone coming into his presence can feel this deeply moving climate." End quote. She spoke of her own personal experiences, such as that concerning a photograph she had taken of Baba and had developed in the United States. Someone, leafing through her album, came across the picture and asked, "Mataji," mother, a name of respect given Indra Devi, "why is it covered with dust?" She looked at it and became almost speechless. The dust, to her, was obviously Vibhuti, materializing on the photograph 12,000 miles from Sai Baba. "I framed it, and the Vibhuti continues to be produced," she said reverently. She showed me the now framed photograph. Clumps of caked, dust-like material filled the space between the photograph and glass. Quite unusual, perhaps, but hardly convincing evidence of a miracle. She thinks I'm going to believe all these stories because of this proof? How easy for someone to have tricked her. Or she may have done it herself for all I know. Certainly no evidence that the Messiah has come, I thought. Very interesting, I heard myself say. On and on went Sai Baba's ardent devotee, speaking at such length about his greatness and his limitless power and telling such unbelievable tales that I finally couldn't absorb any more and my mind became dulled. She continued to speak in this electrified manner, taking us around her home and pointing out numerous objects which Sai Baba had supposedly materialized. What a strange experience. Here I was, bombarded, knocked about, silly, by all these stories and knowing all along that they could not possibly be true. While it was true that others there confirmed her accounts, and she gave me names of reputable people who, she said, had seen Sai Baba and been transformed, this was simply not my reality. Indra Devi was probably experiencing a fugue state, in which, from her great need to believe, she would run around in a sleep-like trance, placing objects here and there and sprinkling Vibhuti around, and then, on waking, unconscious of her previous behavior, would attribute the occurrences to Sai Baba. She smiled at me knowingly. She said, "When I first heard of Sai Baba, I couldn't believe that such a person really existed either. People filled me to the brim with stories until I couldn't believe another word. It was as if I'd eaten too much sugar and couldn't stomach any more. I had to get away from it to let all the information settle." End quote. I went home, and as Indra Devi had said of her own reaction, simply couldn't digest the whole thing right away. I made a couple of inquiries of people to whom she had directed me to see if this man actually did exist. I was informed that he not only existed, but that millions of people followed him, and a great deal had been written about him. I was fascinated. A spiritual leader of millions, alive now in India, yet virtually unknown in the Western world. How could this be in an age of electronic global communication, especially if even one-thousandth of what was reported about him was true? It happened very quickly for me. I decided to go to India to see Sai Baba for myself. Of course, I was familiar with other accounts of the kind of phenomena credited to him, clairvoyance, telepathy, and other so-called psychic powers, such as the stories of Christ's miracles. I had always assumed them to be tricks of perception recorded by gullible or careless historians and reporters. To my way of thinking, a belief in miracles grew out of psychological phenomena such as mass hysteria or group delusion or the ability of someone to wield an uncanny influence over others to the point of altering their perception of reality. The opportunity of observing such events at first hand and of investigating their psychological mechanisms myself was very appealing. I felt that observing Sai Baba in person would give me an idea of what might have happened at the time of Christ to propagate those incredible stories. Isn't it strange, I felt, how such an individual system of reality can be compromised by the need to believe? We're such small, insignificant, and vulnerable beings, too frightened to accept reality as it is, having to manufacture a God and other realms of existence in order to feel safer, more secure. I had always believed, much like the pragmatic existentialist, that life is rather absurd, incomprehensible, and meaningless, that we are some sort of freak mistake of nature coming from nowhere, going nowhere, born in a dark, confusing setting in which people are constantly warring and fighting, being cruel and unfeeling to one another. I had always felt that at best, we could get a few kicks out of life, some fleeting, momentary pleasures, and that was that. But still in all, what was this strange, eerie, almost electrifying feeling inside at the thought of the possibility of a higher reality, a higher order of consciousness and love? No, that was just neurosis. I had put those ideas away a long time ago, maybe even before I was a teenager, because it was weak to give in to the need to believe in something beyond the perception of the senses, nor was there any proof that anything beyond the senses existed. It so happened that Indra Devi would be going to India a month after our first meeting. I decided to go with her. I would go as a scientist to study and understand the psychological realities of a situation shrouded in mysticism to prove that miracles do not exist. This chapter ends with two quotations from Satya Sai Baba. First quotation. You might have heard people talk about the miracles of my taking this and giving that, of my fulfilling all your wants, etc., of my curing your illness. But they are not so important as the sattva-guna, spiritual quality of steadiness, purity, and unselfishness I promote and appreciate and instill. Of course, I confer on you these boons of health and prosperity so that you might, with greater enthusiasm and with less interruption, proceed with the spiritual sadhana, spiritual work. Second quotation. Everyone has to be asked to approach me and experience me in order to get an idea of a mountain. It is not enough if you show a stone and say, the mountain is a million times the size of this. You will have to see an actual mountain, at least from a distance.